Douglas Crook, Wednesday, June 19th, 2013.
On Wednesday nights, we are studying in the book of Job in the Old Testament, right before the book of Psalms. And so if you want to open your Bibles this evening to Job chapter 31, we're ready for chapter 31. There are Bibles in the pew in front of you if you need a Bible, if your eyes are good enough to see the small print anyway. One thing I appreciate about the digital age is I can make the font as big as I want. And I'm afraid I'm getting to two letters per page anymore. Not quite that bad, but Job chapter 31, and we'll begin at verse 1. Remember, last week, or two weeks ago, we considered chapters 29 and 30, and in chapter 29, Job was remembering the blessings that were his before this current trial that he's in, which has lasted at least many months. We don't know how many, but this is a very long, extended trial. And he was remembering in chapter 29 just how blessed he was. And then in chapter 30, he illustrates for us with his words, describes for us his present condition, his physical suffering, his financial loss, his social status had fallen to be below the lowest of society, and the lowest of society mocked him and looked down at him. So this was a man in the deepest pit of despair because of his suffering. And yet in all of his suffering, Job continues to acknowledge God as God, continues to worship him. And remember how this all began was Satan accused him. And he said to God, the only reason that Job worships you is because you give him stuff, because you give him things, because you bless him. And God said, no, that's not true. Job truly understands who I am and worships me for who I am. He fears me. He stands in awe of who I am because he understands and worships me as God. And so Satan said, well, yeah, that's easy to say, but let me take some things away from him. Let me lift up that hedge of protection for just a little bit. Let it down so I can get in and get at him. And so God does. God is proving Job's faith to be genuine. Now remember that Job suffered these things before God had revealed so much of his plan and his own character and his own dealings, certainly before the New Testament, before the law of Moses was even given. And so Job didn't have a lot to go on, only what had been handed down to him through the testimony from Adam on down to whatever generation Job happens to be a part of. And so he really doesn't have a lot of reference materials to know, but there are things that he knows about God that his three comforters don't seem to know. And so he's still confused. And this is part of the work that God's doing for Job, is giving Job a better understanding. God is giving Job a better understanding of himself. He's going to give him a greater revelation. He's drawing him closer to himself. And so Job's going to have a more complete understanding before we're done. But right now we see a lot of confusion in Job, despite the fact that the foundation of his faith has never shaken. It still stands firm. But almost everything else is up for grabs. I don't understand what's happening to me. I can't explain it. And then we have the three comforters accusing him of some of the most vilest of crimes and sins. Says, Job, you must be a sinner. You must have done these things or God wouldn't allow this to happen. And so Job now in chapter 31 is going to go on to once again proclaim his innocence. Now remember, when Job is proclaiming innocence and blamelessness, he's not saying that I've never sinned. He's not saying that he's never failed God. He's simply saying there's no secret sin in my life that I have not brought before God and applied his grace and offered the proper sacrifice. He's simply saying that my life is transparent before God and before man. And so there are no secret sins that I'm hiding for which God is punishing me. So he's going to explain that. And in this chapter 31, it's interesting how much Job does really understand about God and his ways when he had so little to go on, when God's revealed will was not very progressed in Job's day. And yet Job understands the will of God in ways that even Christians today, many Christians today, in the fullness of the revelation of the will of God, they still don't understand some of the things that Job understood back in this 31st chapter. So we'll notice some of those things as we go. So let's begin in chapter 31 of Job, verse 1. I have made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman? For what is the allotment of God from above, and the inheritance of the Almighty from on high? Is it not destruction for the wicked, and disaster for the workers of iniquity? Does he not see my ways and count all of my steps? Job in this passage is saying, I'm innocent of sexual sins, the sin of lust, and disrespect for the opposite sex. He says that's something that I take seriously. And that's something that I know that God sees me even in secret. Once again, this is something that many Christians don't seem to understand. But Job understands, why would I try to hide my sin when I know God sees my ways, even when the doors are closed and no one else can see me? I know the judge still sees me. Verse 5, if I have walked, you'll see this repeated in this chapter. Job says, if and then. He's saying, if I've committed these things, then I deserve the punishment of God. If I did these things, then yes, this should happen. So Job understands that there's accountability. If I have walked with falsehood, or if my foot has hastened to deceit, let me be weighed on honest scales, that God may know my integrity. If my step has turned from the way, or my heart walked after my eyes, or if any spot adheres to my hands, then let me sow and another eat. Yes, let my harvest be rooted out. Job is saying here that he is innocent of dishonesty in his business. Remember, he was a very wealthy man. And he has been accused of being dishonest, and that's how he got so rich. Job says, no, he's never knowingly cheated by weighing with false weights, which was, of course, was the most popular way in that day, in that culture, to exchange goods. They would literally use a scale. He says, if I've used false scales, if I've cheated, then may I be weighed on the scales of God's justice. And he says, I know if I've cheated, I'm going to come up on the short end of the deal. And so he's aware of that. He says, I'm innocent of defrauding people in my business. Verse 9, if my heart has been enticed by a woman, or if I have lurked at my neighbor's door, then let my wife grind for another, and let others bow down over her, for that would be wickedness. Yes, it would be iniquity deserving of judgment, for that would be a fire that consumes to destruction and would root out all of my increase. Job's saying, I'm not guilty of adultery. He understands the seriousness of such a sin before God. And so he's not taking any of these accusations lightly. He says, if I'm guilty of these things, then absolutely, God should punish me. And this, of course, was their accusation, that God's punishing you because of these sins. What Job's accusers did not comprehend was that there are times when God uses the suffering of people who fear him, who trust him, who believe in him, who please him. God uses difficult circumstances to minister to their spiritual well-being. And to know God better and in a deeper way, in a more profound way, is of eternal worth. And Job's accusers weren't taking that into consideration in their accusations. But Job says, hey, I know how serious sin is, and I'm not guilty of this sin of adultery either. Verse 13, if I have despised the cause of my male or female servant when they complained against me, what then shall I do when God rises up? When he punishes, how shall I answer him? Did not he who made me in the womb make them? Did not the same one fashion us in the womb? This is one of those, each of these understandings of the seriousness of these sins is a wonderful insight into Job's understanding of the righteousness of God and of God's will for our life. And this one to me is impressive. Remember, Job was probably one of the richest men, certainly in his village or city. And sometimes riches tend to corrupt you, cause you to treat others that aren't as rich as you or that can't contribute to your riches, to treat them in a way that is, cruel sometimes. And Job says that if any of my servants have come up to me and complained of me mistreating them or not providing something that should be provided for them, if I have ignored them, if I have taken advantage of them, then I am accountable to my Creator because I'm not better than them. The same God that created me created them. And this, he expresses the understanding of the equality of men before God as far as the value of men, the value of life before God. The answer to all of the world's social, racial, and economic injustices, and there are a few of those, aren't there? And they still exist, even in our country. There are still social, racial, economic injustices. But the answer to all of those problems is found in the truth of Job's words. Let's go to the New Testament, where we see that this is actually New Testament doctrine. Ephesians 6, 5 through 9. Again, Job, in that early stage of history, in that early stage of the developing revelation of the will of God, Job understood things that you and I are supposed to fully comprehend and practice and be characterized by in this church age. Ephesians 6, 5 through 9. Bondservants, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling in sincerity of heart as to Christ. Not with eye service as men pleasers, but as bondservants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, with good will doing service as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that whatever good anyone does, he will receive the same from the Lord, whether he is a slave or free. Okay, that's the slave's attitude. And in our day, comparison would be of an employee, a worker. That should be our mentality. You should be the best worker, the best employee you could possibly be. Why? Because you do it as unto the Lord. Everything you say, whatever you say, you do as unto the Lord for His glory and for His good, because as a child of God, you reflect on your Father, no matter where you are or what you're doing. So when you're serving your master, when you're working, you do it as unto the Lord. But then notice verse 9, the same grace of God that is able to do that in the heart of a slave, a servant, is also the same grace that can work in the heart of the master. And you, masters, do the same things to them, giving up threatening, knowing that your own master also is in heaven and there is no partiality with him. That sounds a lot like what Job said he understood. The same God created us both, rich and poor. master, slave. Whatever the social status is, God created us all, and we are equal in his sight. And this is why Job says, I wouldn't cheat, and I didn't cheat those that were in my care. Verse 16 of back in Job 31. So remember this in your activities. If you are a supervisor at work, make sure your heart is right in how you treat those under your care. If you are one who is on the bottom of the totem pole, and sometimes that's not the most pleasant place to be, but if you do it as unto the Lord, the Lord will honor you. So these truths that only the grace of God can work in us and that only God's people can truly implement. We're not talking about self-help programs or trying to turn over a new leaf or trying to be the best person you can be. We're talking about surrendering your will to the will of God and to the life of Christ that's within you. If you do that, these things will manifest in your life. Job understood this was the will of God, and this is what he allowed the grace of God, even back then, to work in his life. This is why God had such a high praise for Job. You're beginning to understand why God said, this is a man of integrity, a man that is blameless, a man who fears me. And Job is simply confirming that he knew this to be the will of God, and this is what he allowed God to do in his life. Verse 16, if I have kept the poor from their desire, or caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or eaten my morsel by myself so that the fatherless could not eat of it, but from my youth I reared him as a father, and from my mother's womb I guided the widow. In other words, Job has a lifelong history of helping the poor. He was accused of taking advantage of them, but he says, no. If I have seen anyone perish for lack of clothing, or any poor man without covering, if his heart has not blessed me, and if he has not warmed with the was not warmed with the fleece of my sheep, if I have raised my hand against the fatherless when I saw I had help in the gate, then let my arm fall off of my shoulder. Let my arm be torn from the socket. If I'm not going to serve with these members of my body, then they're useless. Tear them off. God gave them to me to serve, and that's what I've done. For destruction from God is a terror to me, and because of his magnificence, I cannot endure. Job has not been insensitive to the plight of the poor or the vulnerable. And quite the contrary, he says, From a young man, he has always been the advocate and provider of the poor. Once again, a truth that is revealed to us in the gospel of Jesus Christ. And James tells us, you know, if you have someone comes to your door and says they're cold, and you say, well, go and be warmed, and you don't give them something to wear, he said, that's not faith, that's not love. Job, way back then, understood that wasn't right. And so he let God form his character and practice these things even when he did not have the revelation that you and I have. Verse 24, if I have made gold my hope. Now remember, he was also directly accused of lusting after his wealth. You worship your money, Job. It was a direct accusation by one of his friends, so-called friends. He says, if that's true, if I've made gold my hope, or said to find gold, you are my confidence, if I have rejoiced because my wealth was great and because my hand had gained much, if I have observed the sun when it shines or the moon moving in brightness so that my heart has been secretly enticed and my mouth has kissed my hand, this also would be an iniquity deserving of judgment, for I would have denied God who is above. Job understands the seriousness of the sin of trusting in one's riches and one's talents and one's abilities to make money and to do well. He says such arrogance denies the goodness and the mercy of God that gives those things. And once again, Job understands some things. He was blessed, and he knew that his blessings were of God. He never boasted. You know, I'm such a businessman. I can touch anything and turn it into gold. Have you ever been around a rich, powerful, successful person, and they just turn your stomach with their arrogance? It's like, you know, I bet you wish you were like me. You were as rich and smart and powerful. Job was accused of that kind of mentality. But Job says, no. I always understood those things were mine because God in his mercy and his grace blessed me. I didn't deserve them, but he blessed me. And to trust in your abilities or brag about your abilities or brag about your wealth, he says that's a direct insult to the God who gave me those things. Why would I do that, he said. The human race truly is worthy of the judgment of God because they continue to mock the very existence of God, and they boast in their own mentality, their own intelligence, rather, their own technology and their ability. Man truly is worthy of judgment because of their arrogance against God, who in his love and mercy has given them life. But Job, he understood this, and he would not fall into that sin, and had not. Verse 29, if I have rejoiced at the destruction of him who hated me. Now again, he's going into New Testament stuff here. Now he's talking about his enemies. He says, if I have rejoiced at the destruction of him who hated me, or lifted myself up when evil found him, indeed I have not allowed my mouth to sin by asking for a curse on his soul. So Job even treated his enemies with respect and fear. Now that he was way ahead of his time, wasn't he? Let's go to Matthew 5 and see what Jesus taught, which was a shock to the religious Pharisees of his day. But it shouldn't have been, because Job taught it way back yonder. Matthew 5 and verse 43. We'll read 43 to 48. Jesus said, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be the sons of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet your brother only, what do you do more than others? Do not even the tax collectors do so? Therefore you shall be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. Job did not curse his enemy. Now, it doesn't say that he prayed for them, but at least he understood that there was still a respect for their very life, and knew that they were God's responsibility and not his. And we certainly, as the children of God, with this clear revelation in the gospel of Jesus Christ, need to understand that even those who are against us, whether they be friends or family or co-workers or bosses or whoever they may be, neighbors, that when they purposely, and there are those that viciously, sometimes it's just because you're a Christian, sometimes it's because some people are just nasty, and there doesn't seem to be any reason for it. But no matter what, our responsibility is to understand, first of all, that our battle, our warfare, is not with flesh and blood. It's a spiritual battle. And that we are ambassadors of Christ. And so our responsibility is to pray for them that they would come to know Christ, and that they would allow Christ to change their life as he has changed ours. But if we treat those who treat us well, if we treat them well, well, that's what the world does. The world can do that. But only the child of God can truly love their enemy. And that is, be committed to do what is in their eternal best interest. Again, understand that when we talk about New Testament love, we're not talking about just hugging on everybody and just warm, fuzzy feelings. We're talking about a commitment to do what's in their best interest. Now, sometimes that best interest involves correction. Sometimes it involves separation. Sometimes it involves a lot of things that some people would say, well, that's not right. That's nasty. That's not being kind. Well, we do what we do in the light of the Word of God. He tells us what's in their eternal best. So He tells us how we express love. But there still needs to be that commitment to their well-being. Verse 31. If the men of my tent have not said, who is there that has not been satisfied with his tent? But no sojourner had had to lodge in the street, for I have opened my doors to the traveler. Job's saying, I was hospitable. And this was something that was practiced in that day, and in that it was the custom of that day, because there weren't hotels and motels, and so a stranger, especially of the same tribe, and then later as the nation of Israel, as things were given, orders were given to them, when a Jew from out of town came in, you were to put them up, whether you knew them or not, you were to be hospitable to them. Hebrews 13, we have some New Testament teaching on this as well. Hebrews 13, 1 and 2. In our day and age, we don't like to be inconvenienced by others. And obviously we live in a different time. And we understand that we do have motels. We do have options that we didn't have, that Job didn't have and those of his day didn't have. But nonetheless, we should still have this mentality and manifest it and express it as God gives us opportunity, especially to our brothers and sisters in Christ. Hebrews 13, 1 and 2 says, let brotherly love continue. Do not forget to entertain strangers, for by so doing, some have unwittingly entertained angels. Interesting. That God sometimes has allowed from different times angels to appear as in human form in order to test his people to see if their heart is one of hospitality. Job says his was. Verse 33. If I have covered my transgression as Adam by hiding my iniquity in my bosom because I feared the great multitude and dreaded the contempt of families, so that I kept silent and did not go out of the door. If I did that, again, I'm worthy of the punishment of God. But Job was not guilty of trying to cover up some sin. Now, again, he's not saying that I've never messed up or that I've never sinned, but he's not guilty of trying to hide anything from God. Those sins that he has committed, he has brought before God and applied the grace of God that was revealed to the degree that was revealed to Job at the time. And he says, I'm not hiding anything. I'm not hiding like Adam tried to hide, because I know that doesn't work. Verse 35. Oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my mark. That is my signature on this petition. He's presenting this chapter as a petition of his innocence. And he signs it. Said, this is a true statement. These things are true, that I'm not guilty of these things. Oh, that the Almighty would answer me, that my prosecutor had written a book. Surely I would carry it on my shoulder and bind it on me like a crown. I would declare to him the number of my steps. Like a prince, I would approach him. If my land cries out against me and its furrows weep together, if I have eaten its fruit without money, or caused its owners to lose their lives, then let thistles grow instead of wheat and weeds instead of barley. The words of Job are ended. Now, again, Job, his faith remains firm in God and in God's justice. Job is confused, and Job says some things he shouldn't say. There's no way. Some people who understand how important it is for us to agree with God's testimony of Job, and it is important. We say about Job what God says. He's blameless. He's a man of integrity. He's a man who fears God. No matter what else happens, we're going to agree with God on that. But nowhere are we told in Scripture that we have to, in order to agree with that statement, we have to say that everything Job said was perfectly correct. Because we're going to find out it wasn't. God himself is going to rebuke Job directly. But not for the things for which he's been accused by the others. God knows Job's heart. Some of the things that Job says are due to the fact, not that he doesn't fear God or trust God, but that he simply doesn't understand. And he expresses that misunderstanding of the things of God. And one of the things that he says here is God needs to answer me on these things. Because I know God's just, and I know I'm not hiding anything. So what's happening here? And God, you need to stand up here and tell me what's going on. Well, no matter how righteous you are, as Job was, no matter how pleasing you are to God in your life, none of us had the right to tell God what to do or when to do it. Now, there are times when we would like to say, God, I need patience and I need it right now. But we have to continue to learn to wait on God. Now, we have so much more advantage over Job because our understanding is more complete. And the revelation is full. It's complete for us to understand God's ways. Job was getting there. And so we don't blame Job. We don't jump on the bandwagon of the accusers and say things about Job that God has not said. But here Job, in his confusion, says, here, I've signed this letter, this petition of my innocence. Now, God, you need to answer me. Well, God is going to answer him, but he's not going to give him the answers that he demands. In fact, God does not address any of Job's issues. Job, God doesn't answer any of his questions. God, why did you do this? Why did you do that? God simply reminds Job, or will when we get there, Job, I'm God, and you're not. And Job, it's like the light goes on for Job, and this fog clears, and he begins to understand. He knows God is just, and he comes to understand that God even uses the difficult things to do what is right for Job for eternity. And that's a very important lesson for all of us to learn. Job makes a plea here to God, the judge, and he knows he's the one and only final judge. He says, God, speak up and defend me. Or if not, at least show the evidence of my guilt so I will know it, because I clearly don't know it. Show me the evidence of my guilt, and then I'll accept the treatment that I deserve. But he says, I don't understand this treatment. If he is found guilty of any of these crimes that he listed here, he says, I accept my punishment because I submit to the righteous judge. He has a right to judge me. In chapter 32, we won't begin that tonight, but we're suddenly introduced to a fourth man in the debate over Job's case. I'll go ahead and give you the introduction. If you want to read ahead, you can kind of use this as a little flashlight to see what to expect from this man. This fourth man has been silent up until now. We're not even told he's sitting there listening. We don't know he's sitting there listening until we get to chapter 32. But now he sees an opening to speak, since the three older men, the accusers of Job, they have failed to get Job to admit that he sinned. And they've also failed to present any evidence that he actually sinned. And the guy's going to point that out. You know, you've talked about a lot of things, but where's the evidence? You've accused him, but you haven't presented the evidence that says he's worthy of this kind of punishment. This guy's name is Elihu, and he's younger than all three of the other men and younger than Job. And so he has respectfully waited until apparently the three accusers and Job himself, they finally, and some of you are getting there too, I think, they finally run out of words. They quit talking finally. And so everything's silent for a while because it's like two boxers that have just boxed themselves to exhaustion and neither one of them has hit the ground. Job still proclaims he's innocent. They still think he's guilty of vicious crimes, but they can't put the other one on the mat. And so they're just exhausted. And now this younger guy stands up and he says, "Now you need to listen to me." He's angry. He's angry at everybody. He's angry at the position of Job's three accusers. He's angry at Job because Job continues to claim innocence. And not only that, his biggest anger against Job is some of the things that Job has said against God, that God has treated him unjustly. And some of the things that Elihu says are spot on. But like the other three, it's still misapplied to Job's case, and we'll find that as we go on. He's angry at Job for accusing God of being unfair. He proposes that Job is guilty at the very least of pride, but probably more. So Elihu is also going to accuse Job, but his attitude is less severe and less cruel than the other three. He's a little more kind to Job than what we have seen from the other three. Elihu says that the suffering of Job has simply exposed his pride and probably some of the guilt of some other things as well. He believes that God can use suffering to benefit people, which is something that the other three completely refused. But at least this guy realizes that not all suffering is punishment. But sometimes it's protection, sometimes it's guidance, sometimes he understands a little bit more than the other three. He's younger, but he understands a little bit more. That sometimes God uses suffering not merely to punish people, but as a process to deliver them from wrongdoing. But nonetheless, he's still accusing Job of wrongdoing. So he's still wrong in his application. He's gentler. But he comes, Elihu, as you read his speeches, and he's very long-winded. He might have been a crook, I don't know. And by the way, that's our last name, Crook. He may have, he's very, what's a nicer word, verbose, does that apply? He's very wordy. But he felt like he set silent for this whole long debate, and now he's just bursting and says, "You need to listen to me, folks. You're both wrong." And he comes closer to understanding God's ways than the other guys. And this may be why God, when God rebukes the other three, he doesn't mention Elihu. He just mentions the three older guys because they were cruel and they missed the mark completely. At least this guy understands that God sometimes uses suffering for people's good. And the other three didn't want to hear anything about that. So God doesn't directly rebuke this guy. But he does fail to understand Job fully. And he does fail to understand God's working in Job's life. God was simply proving that Job's faith in God was genuine. And God was going to reveal more of himself to Job by way of all of these things. So there was no punishment of wrongdoing. There was not even a gentle deliverance from wrongdoing by these sufferings. That was the opinion that you're going to see of Elihu. So as you read on and read his speeches, you can have a little perspective of what he's going to say, what his position is. He says some good things. He says some things that are right. But he misapplies them to Job's case. So let's close there this evening, if we'll stand, be dismissed.